Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, I'm delighted to present to you Ted Nyman, MD. He is a board certified family medicine physician in the Department of Primary Care at a leading major medical center in Seattle. His research and medical practice are focused on the practical implementation of diet and exercise for health optimization. He is also the author of The PTE Diet, which breaks down the success of every dietary strategy into one simple metric, protein versus energy. On this podcast, MBT Scientific Director Megan Hall interviews Ted about the basic levers that govern physiology and how to achieve mastery over your body composition. Ted talks about the protein to energy ratio and why how much you eat depends on what you eat. He discusses why adequate protein is necessary for longevity and health span and the differences between plant and animal sources of this critical macronutrient. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 a month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where Megan answers questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, attend live, as well as listen to all the replays, covering everything from training late to timing your meals. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's episode with Ted Nyman.
Hi, Ted. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. Before we get into it, one of the reasons that I appreciate your work so much is that you don't really seem to partake in this low carbohydrate, low fat war that seems to be going on, but you instead focus on something that, in my more biased opinion, admittedly is even more important than if you eat low carb or low fat, and that's protein. So before we get there, for people who aren't familiar with who you are, can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Who you are and how you found yourself passionate about the things that you do. In my experience, not many conventionally trained physicians are thinking, much less writing books about nutrition and the importance of muscle mass.
Oh, great. Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's great to talk to you. I'm Ted Nyman. I'm a primary care doctor here in Seattle, Washington. I got out of residency about 20 years ago, and I've just been down in the trenches at a major multi-specialty hospital-based practice in Seattle, just seeing patients of, you know, from all walks of life. And my background is that I was raised Seventh-day Adventist. And as you might know, the Adventists have a very strong health message, but it's extremely weird. It's basically a vegetarian, plant-based, you know, kind of traditionally low fat, low saturated fat take on things. And so I was raised with this very strong, very health-based diet sort of message and background. And I was the product of Adventist education. I went to Loma Linda University in Southern California, which is famous for being a sort of a blue zone plant-based mecca. And I actually came out of all of that with this sort of feeling that diet kind of wasn't that important because my health was not that great. I was surrounded by people whose health was not that great. And yet we were all on, at least on paper, eating, you know, the best diet, air quotes, you know. And so I kind of came from this diet is important background to thinking, okay, diet's actually not that important. And I was taught in medical school that most of the chronic degenerative diseases I was seeing in people were genetic. You know, if both your parents are obese, there's an 80% chance you'll be obese. So that's purely genetic, right? That has nothing to do with diet. If both your parents are type 2 diabetics, you have an 80% chance of being a type 2 diabetic. So that's really not at all about your diet. You just picked the wrong parents. So I was given this really solid diet background that then I didn't honestly believe in because my health sucked. And then I was in medical school taught that it's really mostly genetics and bad luck. And diet is cool, yeah, sure, but it's not really a major driver. It's very peripheral. But in my internship, I came across a patient who read the Atkins book and boom, overnight, just like dropped 30 pounds and cured his diabetes and came off all of his meds and normalized his blood pressure. And I think that really affected me. I was like, oh, wow. You could make one little change to your diet and just radically change, you know, the trajectory of your whole entire health and your life. And that really, really kind of motivated me to research, you know, diet and exercise and health. And I've just been on this journey for the past 20 years. My whole goal with all of this is just to be less wrong than I was before. And I've just been so wrong about diet in the past. It's just criminal. So I'm really just in this desperate attempt to be slightly less wrong than I was last time. And I just spend all my personal and professional time researching not only diet and exercise for health, but also how to communicate it to my clients, you know, because in the primary care world, you know, I might have 15 minutes to talk to somebody. So I've just been working on streamlining the message and finding out what the biggest drivers of health are when it comes to diet and exercise and focusing on those because the more practical and simple you can make it for people, the more successful they're going to be. And that's really kind of where I got to where I'm at, basically just trying to streamline the message so I can democratize diet and exercise for the mainstream and give people, you know, the very biggest tools in the toolbox that are the easiest and the simplest to, you know, understand and implement.
Yeah, I love that. I love the point about being a little less wrong. It's always a good sign when somebody can admit that they've been wrong and, you know, finding more of the truth, even if it's not the, you know, the full truth. I love that. Let's get into this protein energy ratio concept, because I think it's really great. And I love the basic concept because it's super simple, it's easy to grasp, yet it's extraordinarily impactful. And I'm guessing that's why if you have 15, 20 minutes with a patient, it can be a really easy way to explain what you're trying to get at. So can you explain the concept to us?
Yes, absolutely. All right. So this is basically looking at how much protein is in your diet versus non-protein energy, and that's carbs and fats. And in order to sort of arrive at this point, you kind of want to zoom out and look at what is eating in general. Like, what is eating? Well, it turns out that plants are at the base of all food for all animals. So plants make their own food. They're autotrophs, and they basically make their own food. All animals are heterotrophs, and we're only alive because we walk around eating other living organisms, either plants or animals that eat plants. So yeah, plants are basically at the base of the food chain for every animal on the planet. And what plants are doing are two separate things. Number one, they're doing photosynthesis, where they're basically capturing solar energy and just storing it as chains of carbons. And that's either hydrocarbons, which are fats, or carbohydrates, which are carbs. And so you've got these chains of high energy carbon bonds from solar energy, and that's carbs or fats. But then you've got other things that plants are drawing up from the soil, like nitrogen, which is the major component of protein, and all of these other couple dozen minerals that are essential for plant and animal life. And so I like to sort of divide the diet up into carbs and fats, which is basically energy, you know, non-protein energy, and then protein, which your body mostly uses structurally, and these other minerals that come along with it. And this is something that, you know, it's in the animal world, this has been going on for decades, where you look at the carbon to nitrogen ratio of an animal's diet, and every farmer can tell you, you know, that, hey, if we feed the animal too much nitrogen, it's really skinny, and too much carbon, it's really fat, and you can manipulate these levels. And then I'm also just really heavily stealing from the work of Doctors Raubenheimer and Simpson, these two entomology professors in Australia who did decades of research in pretty much all sorts of animal species and realized that most animals have a protein leverage phenomenon where they're basically just going to eat until they get enough protein. And they did a pretty good job of demonstrating that the obesity epidemic was contributed to by protein dilution. You dump in a bunch of refined carbs and fats, you drop the protein percentage of the food in your environment, you just automatically have to eat more carbs and fats to get enough protein to not be hungry. So this is something that's driving obesity, and most people are just blissfully unaware of it. They just really have no idea. So it's kind of a big deal, and it's really important, and it's something that I think your average bodybuilder figured this out, you know, 50 or 100 years ago, where if you prioritize protein over non-protein energy, you end up prioritizing lean mass on your body instead of fat mass on your body. And it's really that simple. You kind of are what you eat. As your protein percentage gets higher and higher, you end up having a higher percentage of lean mass to fat mass. And that's in pretty much any omnivore mammal that we've tested this in. Higher protein percent diets pretty much always lead to lower ad lib energy intakes and basically a higher ratio of lean mass to fat mass on your body.
So as you just noted, you can have a dietary PE ratio. You can also have a PE ratio that relates to your overall body composition, the amount of fat you have versus lean muscle mass you have. And I'm guessing that just favorably skewing that dietary PE ratio higher isn't enough by itself to maximally improve your body's PE ratio, but that you need to do some kind of resistance exercise, strength exercise to send the signal to your muscles to grow and become more metabolically active. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. Well, I mean, to a small, tiny degree, just eating a higher protein to energy ratio of your diet will give you a higher lean mass to fat mass ratio of your body. Definitely. But above a certain point, if you want to add more lean mass, you need some sort of anabolic stimulus, some sort of resistance exercise. Your muscles are not going to get bigger unless they have a really good reason to. Basically, you have to communicate to them that they have to get bigger or you're going to die. And that's what resistance exercise to failure does for you. But yeah, you're not going to just build muscle without anabolic stimulus because that muscle tissue is really expensive to maintain. It has a super high metabolic rate compared to fat. And so it's expensive tissue to have in your body. Your body's not going to do it for no reason.
But that's also part of the reason that it's so good to have around is because it's so expensive, right?
Exactly right. This is where you dispose of, you know, most of your glucose. This is where you dispose of a ton of your triglycerides. This greatly improves your basal metabolic rate. And so the more lean mass you've got, basically the better off you are metabolically and functionally and pretty much any other way you could look at it.
Now, I could make the argument that everyone should care about their PE ratio or their protein to energy ratio, but who should pay the most attention to it? I would guess that based off of your goals, you might need a little bit to be a little bit more strict with a higher PE ratio, or you may be able to slightly relax just a bit, of course, not dropping too low. What are your thoughts? Who should pay the most attention to this?
Right. Well, it's mostly about body composition and then also about how much exercise you're doing, how much energy expenditure you've got. So if you're already at your goal body composition, you're happy with your lean mass to fat mass ratio, and you're just doing tons of cardio, if you're an endurance athlete, if you're running Ironman, you might want a really low protein energy ratio because you're just trying to get more energy. You're just maybe burning thousands of calories. The problem is humans are kind of wired to be lazy as hell. Like our wiring is to do everything as inexpensively as possible from an energy perspective. This is why we invented like TV remote controls and drive-thrus and Uber Eats. And so the whole goal as a human is to conserve as much energy as you can because you don't know when your next meal is coming from. So we're kind of wired to expend very few calories. And the average person is just not doing tons of cardio or exercise. And so I would say for most people, the goal is to increase the protein to energy ratio of your diet. I'm going to add to that the fact that 91% of humans on Earth are over fat. So you've got everybody, almost everyone's over fat. Almost everyone is not expending a ton of energy spontaneously because that's not their natural inclination. And so we're also in a food environment with just massive protein dilution from refined carbs and refined fats. So you're just surrounded with low protein garbage, food like garbage that you have to massively overconsume to get enough protein. So I would say your average person should be paying a lot of attention to the PE ratio of their diet and is probably a candidate for this sort of thing. I would also say that almost every single patient I see in the clinic is looking for body recomposition or would benefit from body recomposition. Everybody wants more lean mass at a lower fat mass. That's what I want constantly. That's what everybody who comes in to see me wants. They're all looking for higher lean mass, lower fat mass that will basically cure all of your type 2 diabetics, that will basically cure anyone with metabolic syndrome, That's what every bodybuilder wants. But what most people don't know is that they're a bodybuilder as well. Everyone is a bodybuilder, and you've literally created the body you're in with the PE ratio of your diet and your exercise decisions, or maybe decisions to not exercise or inability to exercise. And as a result, you kind of built the body that you're in, and everybody's looking for recomp. So, you know, that's why this is a really important concept for just about everybody.
Yeah, totally agree. In your PE diet book, you say how much you eat is completely dependent on what you eat. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Absolutely, right. So everybody eats to satiety. You can't be on a diet where you're just going to stop when you're halfway full. And that's never going to work for any length of time. I mean, you might be able to white knuckle it for a few weeks, but long term, everyone eats to satiety. I'm eating to satiety.
Or over satiety.
Well, right. But they're basically, everyone's eating until they're no longer hungry. And then the question is, how many calories did that take? So it's this concept of satiety per calorie, right? So if I give you this tiny little square of food that's just amazing, and it has your whole day's supply of protein and minerals and micronutrients and essential fatty acids and all this stuff, and it you're completely full afterwards, and you have total satiety all day long, and it was, you know, one calorie, well, then you're going to have no trouble just dieting down as lean as you want to get. But if I have just like, you know, a 10,000 calorie slurry of corn oil and sugar or something that's just pure empty calories and has no protein, no minerals, no micronutrients, none of the things that your brain's looking for after you eat to tell you that you're full. If I'm eating that, I'm just going to get horrible satiety per calorie, and I'm going to end up massively overeating energy calories. And then that's just, I think that's mostly the problem in the modern food environment, is satiety per calorie.
And I would imagine, correct me if you feel differently, that this is why like a well-constructed paleo diet or an ancestral diet is so helpful for a lot of people. There's a good satiety to calorie ratio there.
Right, right. And I would say that that's probably what's driving every single diet religion. So okay. You'll see some amount of success with almost every diet religion that people go on. If they go low fat, they're cutting out a bunch of refined fats that had horrible satiety per calorie, and we're just really adding calories. If you go low carb, you're cutting out a bunch of refined carbs that, you know, added a ton of calories without a lot of satiety. If you go plant-based, maybe you're cutting out a bunch of saturated fat like butter and heavy cream and things like that. If you go paleo, you're cutting out a ton of refined carbs and fats, and you're just automatically going to improve satiety per calorie, improve nutrient density, lower energy density. You're automatically going to eat less. And then you have people who are just totally devoted to that diet religion forever. And the problem is, if they don't understand exactly what drove their success, then you kind of get this religious flavor to it that's a little bit pointless, you know what I mean? And I'm trying to escape the religious dogma of these different diets by really understanding what's driving the success with all of them, so you can kind of mix and match them. It gives you a lot more freedom. It gives you a lot more flexibility. You can kind of eat whatever you want once you know what the rules of the game are. And one of the reasons I wrote the book is really just an escape hatch from like dogmatic low carb and just super dogmatic keto, zero carb, carnivore, paleo. I've been all of these diet religions. Like, I've been embarrassingly devoted to all these diet religions. And before I really understood it, it did have this mystical religious quality for me. I didn't really know why paleo was so effective. I just knew that it was awesome and everybody should be doing it. And now that I really understand what was driving that, it kind of frees me up from having to say, oh, are lentils paleo? Can I not eat them because it's a legume? You know, can I eat the skin on my potato or am I going to die? You know, I think you get a lot of freedom from the religiosity once you really understand satiety per calorie and what's going on, what's under the hood of all these diet religions.
I love that. I love focusing on the positive things that they all have in common versus the things that they don't have in common, the things that they restrict. So let's talk for a few minutes about types of protein. So we know, or most people know or understand, that not all protein is created equal. And I'm going to highlight the difference between plant and animal protein here. So my bias is skewed toward animal protein, giving you the most bang for your buck, so to speak, due to its amino acid profile, and also the fact that animal protein will usually have a superior PE ratio compared to plant protein, because the latter, the plant protein, is packaged with usually a decent amount of fats or carbohydrates, depending on if we're talking about something like legumes or nuts and seeds. And to give an amount of protein, you are typically going to be having to consume many more calories or energy worth of plant protein versus animal protein. So what kind of guidelines do you give or recommendations do you give people around plant versus animal proteins, especially in a world where some people are trying to move more plant-based for one reason or another?
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. So not all proteins are created equal. There are a couple concepts here. First of all, animals are basically this nice mixture of amino acids that it takes to make an animal. So it's like if you look at the Lego kit to build an animal, you've got all the right Legos there for that. And if you look at the Lego kit of amino acids to build a plant, you've got a skewed percentage of all the amino acids, and it's slightly different. And you've got just what you need to make a plant, but not really everything you need in the right ratios to make an animal. So the minute you eat plant proteins instead of animal proteins, you're already kind of going a step down in terms of percentages of all the amino acids that you need to make whatever you're trying to make. So you just immediately have to eat more plant protein to get the same aminos that you get in the same spectrum and the same percentages that you get from animal protein. So that's a slight problem with plant protein right off the bat. Then you've got digestibility. So the World Health Organization has their digestibility indispensable amino acid score, DIAS score for proteins, and you've got things like egg white and whey protein, which are 100%. Like, you absolutely get every bit of the amino acids from that. And then you've got something, you know, kidney beans are maybe 60%. And, you know, soybeans are not too bad at maybe 80%. But then, like, you know, rice protein is way down at like 50. And it just really starts falling off a cliff. So all of your plant proteins are less digestible, less available. They're already a skewed amino acid array that's not the greatest for building an animal. So there's a lot of reasons why plant protein is just not quite as good as animal protein. Now, I will say that some animal protein is problematic in the modern food environment, because we'll try to fatten animals up as much as we can, and then we also dump a bunch more fat in there because the protein's always the most expensive. So if you're just buying the cheapest ground beef you can get, you know, it's from a cow fattened on grain, and they've dumped a bunch of extra fat into the ground beef to make it cheaper, and what you end up with might not have the greatest protein-energy ratio. But then a lot of plant proteins, if you're eating them as a whole food, they're just automatically bundled with so much carbohydrate that it's a horrible PE ratio. So, like, you know, wheat flour, the endosperm of the wheat grain is basically just tons of carbs. So you're automatically getting this huge carbohydrate dilution of your protein. You're getting way too many calories along for the ride. For example, so I eat about 2,000 calories a day and 200 grams of protein. And that's, you know, that's 40% protein. It's really hard to get that in a plant food. If I decided, okay, from now on, I'm getting all my protein from black beans. I'm just going to eat black beans for protein, which are thought of as a very high protein plant food. Yeah, I'd have to eat, you know, 3,500, almost 4,000 calories to get 200 grams of protein from black beans, almost twice as many calories, especially if you look at the digestibility indispensable amino acid score. I mean, it's probably exactly twice as many calories that I'd have to consume, and I would just automatically get fatter. And in fact, I've seen some estimates that if you just snapped your fingers and tomorrow everyone was plant-based and everyone attempted to get the same amount of protein that they're already eating from a plant-based diet, and believe me, they would attempt to get the same amount of protein that they're already eating. That's what protein leverage is. Pretty much everyone would have to eat several hundred more calories a day, and obesity would just get worse. It would really be bad. So I just warn people, you know, try to get the leanest proteins you can. Try to pay attention to how many carbs and fats are coming along for the ride. In the plant-based world, you're already really getting kind of screwed over with a ton of carbs with these proteins. And then the digestibility might not be that great, and the availability might not be that great, and the percentages of the aminos you're getting might not be that great either. So it's just not quite as good. You can do it. You can pull it off. It's a lot easier if you're supplementing. If you're using plant protein powders, you can really cheat that way. I think a lot of the vegans I see who are the most successful are eating these insanely high processed, refined protein foods. They're eating tofu, which is very high protein percentage. They're eating soybean protein powders. They're eating a wheat gluten protein. And some of those are really, really high. Some of those really do work. And you can be, you know, a full-on vegan bodybuilder and probably achieve all your health and body composition goals. But you're definitely supplementing at that point, and you're really paying attention to it.
Right. And I would assume at to some extent, you are then missing out on some level of nutrients if you're consuming more of those processed plant protein sources, correct?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And just being vegan to begin with, I see a lot of vegans who have legitimate iron deficiency. I see some zinc deficiencies. I see, you know, there's a number, you know, B12, of course, there's a number of deficiencies that you're just prone to getting on a pure plant-based diet. And honestly, that's why I don't recommend the extremes. Humans are scientifically omnivores, full stop. I'm not a huge fan of pure carnivory or pure plant-based. It's just really not a good idea. Everything in the whole universe is on this U-shaped curve, and you really don't want to be way off on one end of the U or the other, because it's just, it's going to be possible, but not optimal.
Yep, completely agree. So carbohydrates and fats, as we talked about, make up the energy portion of that PE ratio. And I assume alcohol does to some extent as well. Is that right?
Right. Alcohol's weird. It's kind of in the middle. You know, okay. Carbs are 4 calories per gram. Fats, 9. Alcohol's 7. It has this super high priority, so you have to oxidize it first. It's super toxic. But yeah, alcohol's the 4th macro. But since it's ultra toxic, I really don't mention it in the book much at all.
But anyway, you mentioned in the book that you want to typically avoid eating carbohydrates and fats together. And I'm wondering if you can explain why. So is this more of a hyperpalatability issue, or is there some deeper biochemical reason that you feel you shouldn't do it? I think that it's interesting that the fat-carbohydrate combination really isn't found much in nature, if at all. I think you could probably argue that some nuts are a fat-carb combo, but there's nothing in nature like man-made combinations of carbs and fats like pizza or chips. So can you talk about eating those two things together?
So it's mostly a hedonic argument. So basically, you can take any omnivore mammal and feed it a high energy density carb and fat together, and it'll automatically eat by 30 or 40% of calories. This is some sort of dopamine-based, hedonic, addictive, food reward type brain level phenomenon. So it can't be a low energy density carb and fat. That would be like a steak and a salad, and nobody's going to overeat on that. It's not that hedonic. But if you mix, you know, like heavy cream and sugar together as ice cream or something like that, or flour and sugar and butter and shortbread, or, you know, if you make your french fries, your chips, your donuts, your cookies, your all these foods that are high energy density, we call it the trifecta in the book. It's a high energy density carb and a high energy density fat together. It has to be high carb, high fat, and high energy density. And then everything on the planet is going to overeat it by 30 or 40% of calories and just automatically get fatter. I mean, this is how we have these cafeteria diet studies in the medical literature, where you just feed Little Debbies and donuts and Snickers bars to rats or mice, and boom, you can just fatten them up more than almost any other diet. You know, it's about 40% carb, 50% fat, 10% protein. It's just perfect fattening ratios, and it's basically a Reese's peanut butter cup type ratio of macros. And everything on Earth is going to overeat that. And that's why you have, you know, bears that are around human trash who get really fat, and the raccoons in your dumpster get really fat, and, you know, Pizza Rat in New York is getting really fat. And like, all these animals are just fattening off of human junk food. And it's really because it's hedonic. It's not a biochemical thing. So if you're super, super thin and you have plenty of metabolic flexibility, lots of lean mass, plenty of room in your fat cells, you can eat carbon fat together and it won't like break your system, right? Like you can eat a donut, you can eat a Snickers bar, as long as you're careful of the quantity and you're controlling the quantity and you're managing your hunger with other whole foods, you can do that and you're not going to break yourself. It's not, there's not like a, you know, I heard your interview with Peter from Hyperlipid. I don't think there's a protons thread on you'll instantly break your mitochondria if you eat these at the same time. So it's not really a biochemistry argument. It's more of a hedonic brain level type thing. And that's why your bodybuilders can eat, you know, 90% awesome like egg whites and whey powder and salad, and then have like their Pop-Tart or if it fits your macros or whatever. And they're still very successful because you can get away with that, except for the fact that it's too tasty and too delicious and too hedonic. And if you're not paying attention to it, you're just going to massively overeat.
That makes a lot of sense. From a practical perspective, how do you help people improve their PE ratio? Obviously, there's the book, which is awesome. But if you're talking to a patient in the 15 minutes you have during a session, how to implement some of these things, where do you start the conversation? I'm sure it's, you know, person and context dependent, but do you have people increase the numerator, the protein, reduce the denominator, the energy, the carbs or fats, or both if they're really looking to improve their ratio in body composition?
I like to focus on what you should eat, what you get to eat, what you're supposed to eat, what you need to eat, what you have to eat. If I just told you, okay, don't eat donuts, don't eat cookies, don't eat candy bars, well, screw that. You're going to leave the office. You're going to be starving. You're going to eat a whole box of Krispy Kremes. It's not going to work. But if I said you have to focus on lean protein, you have to physically go to the store and buy a crap ton of lean protein. I want you to have eggs and salmon and the leanest ground beef you can buy and poultry and all this fish and all of these proteins, and you have to eat it, and you know you need, you know, a gram per pound of ideal body weight a day, and like every meal needs to be centered around protein, every snack should be centered around protein. So if you sit down and eat your smoked salmon omelet with a, you know, with asparagus or something, you're just not going to be that hungry. And it's so much easier to just walk past the muffins and the bagels in the break room, you know what I mean? If you've already had your omelet and your fish and your eggs and all of this stuff. So I really like to focus on what you're supposed to eat, what you have to eat, what you need to eat, what you're going to be successful with first. You know, it's all about buying these foods, planning your meals, cooking these foods, eating these foods, and then you can say no to the donut.
I like that. I like focusing on what to eat versus either how much or what not to eat. That makes a lot of sense. I think it gives people a sense of abundance versus restriction, which I think is really important from, you know, I don't want to say a dieting perspective. But yeah, mm-hmm. For sure. And then I think it might be helpful for some people to hear, but can you differentiate between the three types of hunger that you outlined in the book? So I think there was nutrient, energy, and hedonic.
Right. So basically, humans have appetites for five specific things, right? Protein, fat, carbohydrates, and minerals, specifically sodium and calcium. And so you're basically going to eat until you get a certain amount of protein and fat and carbs and minerals and all of this stuff. So that's kind of nutrient hunger. You're going to eat until you get enough nutrients. And that also encompasses energy hunger as well. That's either carbs or fats. You can kind of go either way. Some people have more of a preference for one over the other. Some people need more carbs if they're doing high-intensity exercise or they're burning more glucose. But you're basically going to be hungry for nutrients, which is protein and minerals, hungry for some sort of energy, carbs or fats. And that's two of the three hungers we talk about in the book. The third one is this hedonic hunger where, okay, you just ate a huge steak, a huge salad. You've got all the protein and fiber and minerals and everything else you could possibly want. And then somebody brings out like a scoop of ice cream or whatever. And you're definitely going to eat that too, because like no matter how full you are with protein and nutrients and energy, you're still going to want that because it's just tasty as hell. So that's the hedonic hungers, right? And the whole premise in the book is that if you target the nutrient hunger first, that's protein and minerals. If you target the nutrient hunger first, you're in a much better place to see if you still have energy hunger left. You know what I mean? And you're also going to be able to tell whether that's hedonic hunger or true energy hunger. So if you just eat like a ton of protein, then you're a little bit better able to gauge, okay, do I really need more calories, or, you know, or do I just want to eat these calories? So the whole point of the book is target nutrient hunger first. Front load the protein, right? Target the protein, eat the protein, get that out of the way, because then you can kind of tell if you're dealing with a true energy hunger or you just kind of want to eat because it sounds tasty.
Perfect. Perfect. I love it. From another practical perspective, and because I spend a decent amount of time talking to people about why bulletproof coffee might not be the best breakfast in the world, can you give your two cents on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so refined fats are horrible for satiety per calorie. And a lot of people really screw this up because the refined fats are actually pretty good for satiety. So like, I could eat, you know, 10 sticks of butter and I will be so not hungry. I'll basically be throwing up. It'll be like the highest satiety I've ever had in my life. And then I'll be like, oh, Naaman said refined fats were bad for satiety per calorie, but I ate 10 sticks of butter. I'm the most full I've ever been. Yeah, well, that's also 100 trillion calories. So the satiety per calorie is total garbage. So I would get tons of satiety from just eating like a whole pizza, but it's, you know, 10,000 calories. So when it comes to satiety per calorie, refined fats are the very, very worst. Actually, protein is the best by a mile. And then carbohydrates come in second. And refined fats are actually the least satiating of almost anything you could eat. There's also this kind of really big delay before these refined fats are even absorbed through the wall of your small intestine and packaged into chylomicrons and go through your lymphatic system. And like by the time the fat actually even shows up anywhere, there's a pretty big delay. So nobody's really getting like any sort of performance benefit from refined fats or an ergogenic boost from refined fats, or it's not, you know, it's really not helping you in any way. It's just like a billion calories. So I would say that if you already have too much fat on your body, the last thing you want to do is eat refined fats. We also have studies in the animal world. You can basically fatten any animal on the planet by just pouring refined fats on their food. We've done this in dogs and cats and rats and mice and pigs and primates and humans. You just add a refined fat to any of these animals' food that they're already eating, and they're just going to automatically, passively overeat fat calories. And statistically speaking, every bit of fat you eat just ends up getting stored in your fat cells, where you may or may not release it later if you burn enough calories, you know. So it's probably the worst thing anyone could ever do from a satiety per calorie standpoint. So I'm like extremely unfavorable, in my opinion, to have a bulletproof coffee for breakfast.
And I think something else that people get a little bit confused about is the whole fat oxidation concept. If you're overeating fat, yes, you're still burning fat, but you're not burning the fat that you want to be burning off your body, right?
Right, right. Like, let's say you're on a zero-carb diet. Well, it just comes to straight-up fat balance. If the number of grams of fat you eat per day is higher than the grams you burn every day, you're literally just going to get fatter. So you're kind of coming down to just a war of grams every single day. Like, did I eat a few more grams of fat or did I burn a few more grams of fat with exercise? And if you're trying to burn more grams of fat than you're eating, bulletproof coffee is probably the worst thing on the planet.
Yeah. And in my mind, it's also a missed, you know, if we're talking about getting calories at breakfast, it's a missed opportunity for some protein and some micronutrients as well.
Absolutely. Like the first meal of the day, protein is for sure the most important thing you could eat. And of course, the last meal of the day, protein is the most important thing you could eat too. And I'm sure it's true of every meal in between as well.
I like that. So I don't know if you hear this, but I do hear it occasionally. What about people who are like quote unquote turned off by protein? So do you have any tips for these people? Do you ever, I guess protein powders are an option, but I've found that generally speaking, like the two populations who have the hardest time getting in enough protein during the day are probably the two that arguably could benefit from it the most. So that would be one, women who are concerned about body composition, and two, older people who have become anabolically resistant and just require more protein. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I have a lot of patients who they just don't like meat for some reason, or they never eat red meat, or they hate fish and seafood, or they are allergic to anything out of the ocean, or I have all these sort of special needs groups. And I do like low carb, low fat fermented dairy in these populations. So always a good option is some sort of plain low fat Greek yogurt, some sort of low fat cottage cheese. These are phenomenal, phenomenal protein sources. Any kind of whey powder, any kind of casein powder, fermented dairy is awesome. I like low fat cheese. I like low fat cottage cheese. I'm not a huge fan of a high fat dairy because it's got a horrible satiety per calorie, like butter and sour cream and cream cheese. But if you're on the lower fat side and also the lower carb side, I like those things. I like your, you know, Fairlife ultra filtered low fat milk. This is a really good source of protein. And so I think that humans have used technology our entire existence to feed ourselves. That's our superpower, right? We have this huge brain. We don't have teeth or claws, or we can't, you know, run or climb or fly or anything super good. So what we're good at is using technology to feed ourselves. And that's how we invented cooking and tools. And we have all these techniques, you know, with plant foods. We sprout them and we soak them and we ferment them and we grind them and we crush them and we bake them. And we do all this stuff to our food to try to extract just the part we need out of it. And I don't have a problem with that, right? Humans are cuisinivores. We evolved to eat cooked and processed food, and we evolved to use technology to both get our food and prepare our food. So you can't tell me it's okay to just milk another animal, siphon off all the fat, and eat it as butter, and that's fine for you, but you can't just siphon off all the protein as whey powder, and that's somehow bad. Or you can't tell me butter's fine, but then low-fat cottage cheese is not fine, because, yeah, I think those things are totally okay. And that would be my recommendation to someone who's more vegetarian, or, you know, doesn't want to kill anything with a face, or doesn't like to eat meat, or hates the taste of fish, or, you know, some of these people would really benefit from these alternative dairy proteins.
Okay, cool. Super helpful. We've talked a lot about protein. Is there anything you want to mention about plants, which are good sources of minerals, fiber, and also relatively low in energy?
Yeah, I think that plants have amazing satiety per calorie, especially like your green vegetables and, you know, your low sugar fruit and things like this. The great thing about plants is they have a really, really low energy density. And that's a huge big deal. So the biggest driver of satiety per calorie is probably protein percentage. But the very second one, and only really close behind protein percentage, is energy density. So like humans eat on, you know, on average of 4 or 5 pounds of food a day, right? You're going to eat 4 or 5 pounds of food. You could eat potatoes, which have a super low, you know, boiled potatoes is like 0.9 calories per gram. You could eat 5 pounds of potatoes. It's barely 2,000 calories. Like that's a super low energy density. And that's how people go do the potato hack. That's how people eat an all potato mono diet. And they're eating as much as they want, but they will basically lose fat the entire time. It's because the energy density is so low. So all of your plant foods have this super low energy density, even like, you know, white rice, which I used to think was pure evil because it has carbs. Well, the energy density, it's like 1 calorie per gram. You could eat 5 pounds of white rice. It's 2,000 calories. It's like, kind of, who cares? That's why you can get away with eating, you know, sushi. And that's why the Japanese are so thin. And that's, you look at your, you know, Katavans who are eating all these sweet potatoes. It's, you know, 1 calorie per gram. These are low energy density foods. There are other plant foods that have way, 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 way lower energy density as well. And then you've got things like, you know, your latest Kevin Hall study, where a high-fat animal-based diet got destroyed by a low-fat plant-based diet, where people ate, what, 500, 600, 700 calories a day less spontaneously. And what drove that? They were the same amount of protein. It was really half the energy density in the plant-based, the low-fat plant-based diet. So energy density is a massive big deal. You're going to eat pounds of food every day. If you have a ton of vegetables, you're just going to automatically have a higher satiety per calorie. So I think it's a really big mistake to not eat vegetables. I say go crazy. Eat all the fruit and vegetables you want. I used to freak out about, you know, sugar and fructose and say, oh, you should just only eat low sugar fruit. But then I realized, you know, some of this higher sugar fruit has insanely low energy density, like melon and citrus and berries. I mean, you could eat 4 pounds of strawberries is only 100 grams of net carbs. I mean, that's nothing. It's like the calories are so low. The actual net carbs are so low. These foods are amazing. And I think that if you're totally restricting them, you're basically shooting yourself in the foot from a satiety per calorie point of view and also from an energy density point of view, kind of one and the same. And also, you know, I hate to say it, but if you're trying to eat a zero carbohydrate diet, you're basically ignoring or dismissing the fact that humans do have a specific appetite for carbohydrate every day. And if you're just denying that, you're going to be a little bit hungrier and you might have to actually eat more calories from fat to satisfy this hunger than if you just gave yourself 100 grams of carbs a day for any a couple apples or something like that. So yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with the plant foods. I think there's a reason why all your bodybuilders and bikini models and fitness models and Instagram influencers and everybody are eating these huge salads and tons of cucumbers and lots of berries and basically a bunch of fruit and vegetables. It's really, really helpful in my opinion.
Completely agree. I want to transition just a little bit from talking specifically about protein, plants, and talk a little bit about triglycerides. So I know you've been relatively vocal about not particularly liking to run a lot of fancy blood chemistry tests. And I can definitely appreciate that sometimes, regardless of the results, what you're going to tell someone to do from an interventional perspective will largely be the same. So you're going to tell them to, you know, eat high quality protein, don't consume too much energy from carbohydrates and fats, you know, put good stress on your muscles to make them grow and become more metabolically active. But you've also talked about, you know, certain markers like triglycerides being potentially helpful. Can you explain why you feel like triglycerides are a good basic marker of metabolic health?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. Thank you very much for teeing that one up for me. Like my biggest concern is people being over fat and filling up their fat cells and then being insulin resistant and having metabolic syndrome, which is literally just physically having no good place to put fat in your body, right? So all of your fat cells can only reach a maximum diameter. And then you either have to sprout new ones, or if you can't, that fat energy has no place to go. So once you've hit your personal fat threshold, quote unquote, where you filled up all your fat cells and you can't make any new ones, this fat energy just circulates in your bloodstream. And that's what triglycerides are. So if you take somebody who's really, really thin, right? Super lean, tons of room in their fat cells, you can feed them oral glucose tolerance tests with a bunch of carbs. You can feed them an oral fat tolerance test where they drink 50 grams of heavy cream. You can give them carbs and fats together in a donut. Doesn't matter. Their fat cells are going to suck all that energy right out of their bloodstream on the first pass. And they're basically going to have a very low spike of triglycerides postprandially. And they're going to have super low fasting triglycerides. And this is just a sign of really good metabolic health. It basically means you have lots of headroom in your adipocytes. So you're going to be metabolically flexible. You're going to be able to dispose of glucose or fat. I love low triglycerides. It's like a fuel gauge on your fuel tank, on your gas tank. It basically is sort of telling you the size of your adipocytes, how much room you have in there. Kind of like fasting insulin, which is the exact same thing. Kind of like fasting glucose, which there's a lot of overlap there as well. So you really don't want to have high triglycerides. Anyone who's been fasting for 12 hours should absolutely have triglycerides below 100. You want to be in the double digits. If you're a triple digit triglyceride, you definitely are approaching some sort of insulin resistance. Kind of the cutoff on the triglyceride glucose index is 115. Anything over that, you're definitely for sure insulin resistant. You know, to be elite, you really want to have triglycerides under 70. In a perfect world, your triglycerides are lower than your HDL. So I love fasting triglycerides. Really good thing to pay attention to. It's also going to track linearly with fasting insulin, your waist circumference, just how fat you look in the mirror, and a whole bunch of other stuff.
So in general, the lean, and I'm sure that there are other factors to your personal fat threshold, and that's how much triglycerides are going to be shuttled into fat, adipose tissue versus hanging around in the bloodstream. But in general, the leaner you are, the lower the triglycerides you'll have and the more room in your adipocytes. Is that largely, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. You got it. Mm-hmm.
So you also talk about, which I love, the importance of lean muscle mass from a health span perspective. And I don't want to ask too leading of a question, but I've heard some pretty absurd things about protein recommendations from longevity experts, in quotations, and also doctors. So for example, and this is unfortunately a real example, believe it or not, you know, a smaller, older woman with osteoporosis who's trying to preserve and maybe even gain some lean muscle mass, being told to eat less than 20 grams of protein a day. And I personally feel like that's a little bit borderline malpractice, but I'll refrain from ranting. I'll let you do that. Anyway, we also see people quoting from the scientific literature that low protein diets are better for longevity. And I came from an education where I studied both exercise physiology and also longevity with respect to nutrition. So I heard very smart people arguing for two very different things when it comes to protein. Although, to be honest, my bias has always been more toward more protein and more muscle mass for longevity and health span. But I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Right, right. So, okay, we have a lot of longevity people, you know, your Walter Longos, who are using research from mice and lower organisms to say that, ooh, maybe protein restriction is a good idea. But even in these sorts of low protein, mostly plant-based longevity gurus, they all admit that, oh, if you're 60 or 65, okay, all of a sudden, the more protein you eat, the better. And it just doesn't really make a lot of sense to me that, okay, when you're younger, everybody knows you need way more protein. You're just going to function better. And then once you're older, oh, dang, okay, snap. Yeah, you should eat a lot of protein or you're going to have sarcopenia and osteopenia. And we all know that's just going to kill you because we see that every day in the clinic and in the nursing homes and in the hospitals. So, but there's this mystical middle range where you should just restrict protein because you're going to live longer. I think this is basically garbage. And the reality is that if most of these people feel that there's a protein to carbohydrate ratio you want as low as possible, you want to eat less protein, more carbs. And the reality is old people in America are just killing it on the low protein, high carb diets. The ABC Health Study looked at American adults age 70 to 79. They're eating an average of 68 grams of protein a day with only like 38 grams of animal protein, and they're eating, you know, 270 something grams of carbs, you know, so they're basically eating a fairly low fat, super low protein, very high carbohydrate diet. And I don't know if you've looked around, you know, but like old people are doing really bad in this country, and they're not necessarily living longer either. We have longevity going down at the moment. So that's, you know, it's, I wouldn't say that it's really helping anyone live longer. What it's doing is creating this massive epidemic of frailty and sarcopenia and osteopenia. And there are tons of associational studies that just show that the more lean mass you have, the longer you're going to live in almost a straight line fashion. And that's because the more muscle you have, the more likely you are to survive an illness or a hospitalization. And the less likely you are to have a fall or break a bone. There's also a huge association between protein in the diet and bone density. So, you know, your bones are 50% protein. And the higher your protein in your diet is, the better bone strength you're going to have. So, like, there's a big association, positive association, between bone density and protein intake. So, if you're trying to have more lean mass, more protein, more muscle, higher protein diets are the way to go. We also have no actual real evidence in humans that protein restriction extends lifespan. Like, there's nothing there. There's zero there. We know that having osteopenia and sarcopenia is more likely to kill you off younger, but we've never proven that protein restriction is going to make you live longer. So it's actually completely theoretical. And I don't know if I would trade the very real risks of osteopenia and sarcopenia, which I see every day in people on low protein diets, for the theoretical lifespan improvements from protein restriction, which nobody's ever proven at all. And I think, honestly, it's just like a bunch of crap. I mean, I'm just like, you're going to have to prove it to me or have some sort of human data.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people who point to like the mTOR data are not taking into account tissue specificity when it comes to mTOR, at chronic mTOR stimulation versus acute mTOR stimulation at the level of the muscle. And, you know, that's a whole podcast in and of itself. But you know, there's a lot of mechanistic data that people point to, but then they're not looking at the whole big picture, right?
Right, right. And they're just really not looking at like insulin area under the curve when it comes to mTOR stimulation. If you really want to stimulate mTOR, you don't have to eat any protein. You just have to be really fat 24/7, 365. You're going to get way more insulin signaling and mTOR signaling than being super lean and eating a bunch of protein. So it's kind of just ridiculous. It's more about energy availability, and being fat does that like crazy. So I'd rather someone be super lean and insulin sensitive, even if they're eating nothing but protein or what some of them consider to be a quote high protein diet. I think your area under the curve when it comes to this sort of mTOR stimulation is going to be lower.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that one could argue that if more people followed your advice, type 2 diabetes wouldn't really be a thing, or definitely much less of a thing. Same with obesity. So what do you think stops your advice from being the standard of care? And have you seen any changes, either positive or negative, in the arena of diabetes and obesity treatment and management over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years or so?
I mean, first of all, one of the problems is that the obesity epidemic is purely economic, right? It's massively driven by economic factors. So people who sell low protein foods are just profiting hugely because carbs and fats are cheaper and they have lower refrigeration requirements and easier logistics and longer shelf lives. And the profit per calorie of food is like way, 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 way higher than it is for protein. So nobody profits from higher protein percent diets. Nobody, nobody at all. Even your people who produce proteins, your farmers who are producing beef or pork, benefit from fattening these animals up more and selling a more protein diluted product. They'll actually make more money if the protein percent is lower. So there's absolutely no one who profits from people eating more protein. And I think that's part of the problem. There's just no financial incentive for anybody anywhere to increase the protein percent of anyone's diet. That's just not like, who would profit from that? Nobody. And that's why we don't see it, right? I think if there was more money in it, it would be a little easier to talk people into promoting this. So right now, it's just not talked about. You know, you go to Obesity Week and you hear all about the latest GLP-1 receptor agonist and the latest bariatric device, and it's all about procedures and devices and drugs. And nobody's talking about protein percentage because, like, who's sponsoring that? Who's benefiting from that? Yeah, it's just crickets. So I don't think it's going to get a lot of airtime because nobody makes any money off of it. I think that's too bad because we have studies showing that if you increase protein to 30% of calories, you reverse 100% of pre-diabetics. So that's kind of a big deal. There are estimates from worldwide hunter-gatherer macronutrients that humans, you know, as hunter-gatherers ate, you know, anywhere from 33 to 37% protein diets, these insanely high protein percentage diets, and we're down at 12.5% in America, and nobody's really talking about it. So, yeah, I'm a little depressed about it. I think it's there's some economic reasons why it's not important to anyone. And I don't really see that getting better. And in fact, obesity continues to accelerate. And what professors Raubenheimer and Simpson discovered is that as you get fatter and as you get more insulin resistant, you actually tear up more of the protein you eat for gluconeogenesis, and your protein need goes up proportionally even higher. And they have proposed that that's why obesity continues to accelerate and continues to go up. It's not like, oh, protein got diluted and we all got fatter and then just stopped and plateaued. No, it's still going up. It's still accelerating. It's still accelerating pretty significantly. And it's because as people get more fat, they get more insulin resistant, they tear up more of the protein they eat for glucose and gluconeogenesis, and then they need even more protein, but then they're still in this protein diluted environment. And it's kind of a downward spiral, and it's really depressing. And until we figure out this protein piece and how to promote it and get more people on board, I think we're going to continue to have a problem. So I haven't really seen that get a whole lot better. In fact, the plant-based movement scares me because that's just going to instantly make protein dilution worse for sure. So I'm scared by that movement. I'm also afraid of this protein longevity, protein fear mongering, because that's really not helping anyone at all. And I see that as actually a huge problem. So yeah, that's where I'm at.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really interesting. What about from the behavior change side of things? As a clinician, do you see that being a problem as well for people, especially in a world where we have all of this food availability to us that's high in energy, but not so high in protein? The behavior change, even if they have the information, do you find that being a stumbling block for some people?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it is that these foods are so tasty that if they're in your house, you're just going to eat them, right?
Yep.
Like if I have a box of Krispy Kremes on my kitchen counter, I guarantee you I will eat one of those donuts. Like I absolutely know that I will. What I try to do is I make like this giant blender full of protein ice cream and eat all of that. Or I just eat like a huge salad size my head, or I eat a whole bunch of stuff that's like high protein, high nutrient density. And I eat that first, and then I can maybe eat one donut and just stop there instead of binging and eating the whole box or whatever. So I'm trying to change things so that behaviorally I'm less likely to binge on these foods or overeat on them. But if it's in your environment, you're pretty much going to eat it. And that's how humans are wired. And we're surrounded by it, and it's inescapable. And so the only thing you can do is try to surround yourself with some better stuff and crowd out the donuts as much as you can. And that's what I'm doing. But you're just never going to escape that stuff in the modern food environment. So if you haven't gotten out of your way to eat the protein first, you're eating a whole box of Krispy Kremes. It's brutal.
Yep. You have to, if you can, get it out of the house. That's what I recommend for people, as at least while they're making that transition to, you know, a better higher protein diet, lower energy density diet. Because I'm curious, and I know other people will be, how do you make your high protein ice cream?
Oh, right. So it's a low calorie milk, like an almond milk or a Fairlife fat free milk. Yeah, it's basically a cup of a low calorie milk in your blender with a cup or two of frozen berries. I like, you know, raspberries, strawberries, and then a serving of whey powder. And then you just blend it all up, and it just turns into this sort of thick, creamy ice cream type thing that is super voluminous, tons of weight and volume, and it's extremely high satiety per calorie. And it's just a really good hack for basically being full and eating nothing but protein and a trivial amount of carbs.
Awesome. I like that. Thanks for sharing. So you have a book, The Protein Energy Diet, which I would highly recommend people check out. It's packed with a ton of really great actionable information that I think everyone could benefit from. And I think your infographics are fabulous as well. I think my favorite is the steak and eggs axiom. But apart from the book, how else can people learn more from you? I assume you're seeing patients every day. Talk to me about that.
Right. So I'm seeing patients in person in the Seattle area. Although my practice is full, my practice is closed, it's been closed for a while, I don't do any remote consults, so nobody can really see me anymore in person. But you can check out the book at thepediet.com or anywhere books are sold online. And you can follow me if you want on Twitter and Instagram at Ted Naiman. And I think the book is probably the most useful thing I've got out there.
Cool. Awesome. I would highly recommend it. It's packed with really great information. So, Ted, I feel like I've kind of been in my own little echo chamber talking to somebody about how important protein is and muscle mass is. But I think there are a lot of good reasons to emphasize their importance. So thank you so much for your time. Thank you for all you've done in this space to minimize confusion about what to eat and highlight some super simple yet incredibly effective and impactful interventions.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you for having me. And I want to say that I listened to your podcast on protein, the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast episode you did on protein, and it was amazing. And I listened to that and I was like, oh, yeah, Megan knows exactly what I'm talking about here. So I feel like we're on the same wavelength there, which is awesome. And everybody should go listen to that podcast as well. I'm sure they already have.
Well, thank you.